Well, thank you, John, for your kind introduction, and thank you too to the Foundation and Science of Technology to allow one of their debates to be part of the celebrations of NERC's 50th birthday. About 18 months ago, I think it was, BIS issued its report on the comparative excellence of UK science, which it does from time to time. And I was very interested in that document because what it showed was that for the first time, and on the basis of field-weighted citation data, that environmental science in the UK had moved into first place in terms of the quality of science in the UK. That, I have to say, is a very nice position for a chief executive to find himself. But what struck me more forcefully, in a way, was that this document didn't just summarise citations in the UK. It looked at our competitor nations too, and not simply long-standing competitors such as America or Germany. It also looked at some newer arrivals, China, for example, or South Korea. And what one saw in every single case over the last 5 years was an upward movement in the citation indices in environmental science in all countries in the world. It would be nice to conclude that over the last 5 years there has been a sudden increase in the intelligence and competence of environmental scientists across the world. But if I at least speak for myself, I think this argument it has some flaws in it. And there is at least one other explanation which seems to me to make more sense. Citations are, of course, just as much of a measure of interest as they are of quality. And what I'm sure one's seeing in these citation data is an ever-growing emphasis of the importance of environmental science in policy, in government, in society, and in business. There are other signals as well, many of them actually, of this rising importance of environmental science. I think a very good example is the post-millennial 2015 development goals, which are currently under discussion now at the United Nations. If you compare those with the millennial goals that they replace, you can see a very marked contrast. The millennial goals primarily were focused on human-related indices, poverty, education, and health. If you look at the post-millennial goals, what you can see in them is quite explicit recognition that in the desire of much of the population of the world to meet living standards that here we just take for granted, that in achieving that may simply place a burden on the environment that cannot be met. I also think that there's another message in those goals too. I myself take the view, and I'll distinguish my view, as it were, from NERC's, that this question of resource extraction versus environmental protection is to some extent out of date. First of all, I think it's quite important to understand that there's very little of what one might call the natural world left. Almost every terrestrial land surface that can be lent to production now is used for production. We've substantially emptied the oceans. There are many chemical cycles, nitrogen is a good example, which have just been changed out of all recognition. So there may be one or two places left on Earth which can be reasonably described by the world natural. Center of East Antarctica, perhaps. Some parts of the deep ocean. Certainly not the Arctic. But for the most part, we don't live in a natural world. We live in a world that we are the biggest source of change in. And certainly if you look at much of the science, the vast majority of it, that is now being done and funded by NERC, what one can see is less an emphasis on studying natural systems with us as independent observers. What we're mostly focusing on is the way in which systems which have evolved over millennia to tens of thousands of years are responding to changes that we are shocking the system with over the last 50 or even the last 10. So when one talks about environmental protection, you have to first of all wonder what it is that is being protected, and I think you also have to recognise that the world is driven by human demand. And that the real challenge, I think, to those who wish to take the view that the environment should be protected is tougher than it was, and you can see it very clearly in these post-millennial goals. Protection of itself isn't any longer the objective. I think if you wish to pursue that, you have to show why it is that protecting parts of the environment will benefit the human pursuit of well-being. And as I say, that is very clear in the post-millennial development goals. Question is, of course, what is the role of a research council in questions of this kind? And just to answer my question immediately, it is not to judge. It is to inform. And there's a fable that I like to tell people to try and illustrate what I mean by that point. If you imagine a group of castaways stuck in a very, very cold hut and 1 month from rescue, it's a scientific statement, perhaps, to inform them that if they burn one log per night, they may have a 30% chance of surviving the month. Or, if they burn all their logs in one night, they'll have a 10^-3 probability that none of them will make it. But it isn't actually a scientific problem to say how many logs get burnt. There are limits to the amount that you can do with scientific research. And that's not to underestimate the impact of independent, objective scientific advice. And the history of NERC is replete, in fact, with examples of how that kind of advice has influenced policy and more widely. And of course, it's somewhat iniquitous to choose favourites, because there's always this risk that someone in the audience will be thinking, he hasn't mentioned us. But I'm going to go for three examples because I think they're nicely varied, and they do show the tremendous impact that NERC has had over the last 50 years. I think most of us are familiar with the discovery, which was made by a BASS scientist, of the ozone hole, and then later explored by an NASA scientist. What's perhaps less appreciated about that is that while everyone tends to associate the ozone hole with the Antarctic, it's actually the northern hemisphere which is most exposed in terms of population and biological systems on which we depend to ozone depletion. There was an interesting paper actually in Nature about a month ago which calculated what the impact of the ozone hole in the northern hemisphere, in northern Europe in fact, would have been had the Montreal Protocol not been in place. And the answer is that UV radiation in Northern Europe would have been 10% higher than it is today. And as a very minimum, that would have put 40 million a year, every single year, on the national health system, on the national health system budget. I'm also told that the Montreal Protocol has in fact had 8 times more impact on reducing greenhouse gases than has Kyoto. We also have concerns today about air quality, and particularly in London. But I think we can also forget just how much better things are today than they used to be, and there's a very telling statistic of that. In the 80s, the sulfur content in the air in the Outer Hebrides was higher than it is today in central London. So the NERC-funded activity which led to us unravelling the understanding of acid rain, of its impact on our land surface and in our lakes and in our rivers, had an enormous impact on UK policy, and one could essentially summarise that impact by saying effectively that it was instrumental in the UK cleaning up our Energy Production Act. And finally, success which can be measured by the fact that nobody noticed it. I'm not old enough, I have to admit, to remember the 1953 event of a high tide, high wind, high wave event that hit the East Coast of the UK and devastated a great deal of the east of England and also the Low Countries. What hasn't been noticed very much is that about 18 months ago there was an almost identical event on the east coast of this country. And yet nobody noticed, other than a few locals who went out to see it as a kind of tourist attraction. Why has that great change taken place? Well, the answer is that after the 53 event, there was enormous concentration on understanding the processes that gave rise to those events. It's a Kelvin wave, for those of you who might be interested, on how you move from that understanding to prediction and how you take that understanding and you thread it from the science base through the Meteorological Office, through the Environment Agency, more generally into considerations which led to the Thames Barrage. And in the end, success is measured, as I say, by the fact that nobody noticed that these things occur. So in summary, independent objective advice had a tremendous effect on UK policy, and I think that nowhere is that more true than as it concerns the environment. In 1964, when the discussions were going on about the creation of the research councils in their modern form, there was in fact a proposal to create a natural resources research council. And there was at that time a considerable pushback, notably from a concern that was then called conservation. And out of that discussion and tension came what we now know as the Natural Environmental Research Council. Someone observed to me that if you go back to the 60s, you might have argued that in the 60s, a research council with some focus on conservation was something perhaps that a civilized nation should do. Today, focus on the environment is not something that a civilized nation should do. It's something that is an absolute necessity to the way in which we look into the future. Just to illustrate that, we've become familiar with the idea that there is a safe limit to the amount of carbon dioxide that we can emit into the atmosphere. And it's fair to say, actually, that NERC-funded science and UK science more broadly, notably the Met Office and the Hadley Centre, have actually made a huge contribution to the understanding of the physical climate system. But there remains other questions which we could frankly admit today we have much less interest, much less insight. For example, is there a minimum level to the biodiversity that we have to maintain before, as it were, the system falls over? Is there a maximum level, the amount we can demand from our soil or from our water before the system falls over? These are not abstract problems, they are very real problems. I was discussing somebody with the World Bank just 2 weeks ago who focused in on exactly those two questions as the ones they have least understanding of and yet would have most impact if we could make some inroads. More applied and more broadly too, there are other questions. Can we reach a common economic framework in which the tension between our impact on the environment on the one hand and the profit that we derive from it on the other can be understood in economic terms and perhaps even more importantly, widely agreed? Because if you look at the way the world works, you realise that without such a common economic framework, it will be very difficult, even with detailed scientific understanding, to reach the balance which we all sense somehow or another we've got to reach. So I think that's probably, as it were, a good place to stop. Given the questions I just laid out, and if you think about them a little and start to work your way down, you'll see these are subjects of huge complexity. So in that sense, I've no doubt that NERC and its wider sister councils is going to have its work cut out over the next 50 years, just as it has done for the last 50. Thank you.